Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1-cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Hello.
Greetings, James. Welcome.
How are you?
I am very cheered that you can speak today on the last day of
well,
the year.
Well, I am so sorry about the... last night. Do you want me to record my own audio, John? Would that be helpful?
It's fine. Yes, a backup is always welcome. I'm recording us on audio, and then we'll be on video as well. So your backup is wonderful. Anyway,
okay,
it's a great pleasure.
I basically I just got the wrong hour.
Yeah, sure.
I had it in my diary, and it was bleeping up, but I was an hour. I was out by an hour or 2 hours, but anyway, I was out. So I'm so sorry.
You gave me an extra night with the boys. So,
anyway, how are you? Have you had a good Christmas?
I have a very good Christmas. The children were home. We've got grown children,
nice.
But they're not married yet. And okay. They were home, and that's always a pleasure. And when they leave, the house gets too quiet. Do you have children, James?
I do, yes. I've got a son and a daughter, and the son has left home and is now trying to find his fame and fortune in London and is back for the holidays, which is great. And I've got a daughter who's still at college, but school.
You understand then how quiet it gets when they're away.
Oh, my goodness me. Ned spends his whole time playing the piano and playing the guitar, so when he's not around, it always seems very quiet.
Oh, I see. He's our Harry Wilson figure, is he? Yes, of course.
A little bit of fun, yes. Dear old Harry, he's quite the character, isn't he?
I wrote you this morning that I wanted to include the profiles of Farley Mowat, who is my favorite, absolute favorite.
Total legend.
Harry Wilson I like just because, oh, well, what the heck, you know, there's been this Dunkirk thing. I think I'll sign up. Okay, fine. And Mouse, I didn't include in my note to you Mouse because he was at headquarters and he saw so much, but he was a Nazi.
I always think Jörg Zellner's, well, I've got such a soft spot for him, and Hans Golder, the two of the Germans. It's impossible not to like them.
I understand. I had to choose one, and I wanted the politics to come into this.
He's
Marburg, and he's a veteran of the First War.
And he's not a man without culture and sensitivity, but he is a Nazi. There's no getting away from it. You know.
And he knows Huber and Balk, who do.
He's in total thrall.
Pencer Group, 14 Pencer Corps is into the fight. So here's what I propose. It's way too much. I sent you an outline. So much of it we can do from the point of view of the commanders to set up and then just say that the extraordinary aggression of the American and British and Canadian and French doesn't match up to what you'd think you could do on these mountains. You kept saying, you know, how did they make any progress at all? But I want to fit this into Overlord, because although you've written that book, and I just recently listened to it in anticipation of this one, because that's sort of out of order. It's afterwards. Overlord is here everywhere. It hangs in the air. Although they don't, we know what's going to happen. They don't. That's what's fun about it. Baytown and Avalanche, just to set up what was coming up right side. Yep. And then the Salerno counterattack and Termoli, I included because Termoli, because it gets Montgomery into the battle and uses amphibious and armor. And the first hour, the first four segments with the Volturno, what the challenge is ahead. Then we begin with Naples and Rome and Overlord. And Carbly, I choose him because he's a survivor and also because of that rant he went into when he realized he'd been betrayed. Wonderful revelation.
Amazing that the spook has been betrayed. I mean, it's just...
And he knew everybody.
It's amazing.
He knew everybody.
Yeah.
So Carbely would be my... And then the Bernhard Line, the Gustav Line, the mission, Kesselring, Rommel to France, you know, foreshadowing. And then the two battles that are so extremely tragic, San Pietro and Ortona, and the death of Rosa Fuoco.
Rosa Fuoco haunts me to this day, John.
Yes, you've got a picture.
You know, you don't want to stint on these things. You want people to realize that.
Who took that?
You know,
picture? Who took that picture?
A U.S. film unit, U.S. cameraman. They operate in these. They would have one cheap driver, one guy with a movie camera, and one with a stills camera. Yeah. It was the stills guy.
And then finally, Christmas, Farley Mowat, and the Campbell poem. Yes,
so tragic.
Yes, and Harry Wilson, and at Christmas, knowing the story's coming. I know what's coming next. It's Enzio is coming. Yes, they don't know. We know. And a question outside of this, James, the rain. I've run into this repeatedly over the decades, and I've never asked this question. Did the guns make the rain?
No, I don't think so. Okay. Just the winters in Europe in 1940s were just absolutely brutal. Worst one of all was 1947, 48. But no, I don't think so. Because, we wondered whether the kind of vast amounts of ordnance and all the rest of it, whether they had a kind of effect on global warming or the atmospherics. I think, if it did, it was negligible.
Okay. The rain.
It was just really bad. I mean, it was, the winter of 1939-40 was brutal. They all were. They were all absolutely dreadful. Just a particularly cold decade, which was misfortunate for...
The
misfortune of those who were caught up in it.
I should have rushed to say this everywhere. You've done the masterful job you've done before. I do not take you for granted. The level of research here, I read your acknowledgments at the end. My God, a cast of hundreds. All those museums.
Yes. Well, these things are sort of years in the accumulating, then written in a fiery spurt.
and their children. I know in my family, my father-in-law was in Italy, and he lost his son-in-law, his brother-in-law, on Anzio. Crashed a Spitfire that he wasn't used to flying.
Wow!
And my father was Omaha.
Wow! Goodness me!
But they didn't talk about it, so I have to read you to know what happened.
Yeah, amazing. That's not untypical. I mean, lots of people just didn't want to talk about, awful experiences like that to their own family. That's the thing.
I know, but that what now is happening is the sons and grandsons of the people who didn't talk. We have mementos, diaries, as you say. So there's a new understanding. Once you get away from the generation that was there, there's a new understanding of what it was compared to. And that's what I get out of your book. Sicily was a surprise to me, but this one I knew about because of my father-in-law, who didn't talk. He was a supply officer resupplying for fuel and ammo to those Shermans up there on the heights.
Yeah.
And Purple Heart, Bronze Star, the usual because of the...
Yep.
And he was wounded by stones, the way you talk about the artillery hitting, taking them down. But the story that you tell is, I think he's wounded after Rome, not before Rome.
Yep.
So in the summer of 44.
Right. And John, tell me on a practical note, you've got church to go to?
I do. And I'm
So how long are we? How long have we got?
75 minutes. We'll be done. It will be done before 9:30.
Perfect.
Okay. Here we go. I've got everything lined up. Now I'm going to turn on the video.
Okay.
And James, this is a great treat for me. Thank you.
If we've got a video, let me put. I've got an appropriate jacket. Let me get it for you. Hold on a few seconds. Here we are.
Recording in progress.
There are U.S. Fifth Army.
Okay. Wonderful. It's fun. You're attracted to the you do the Fifth, and I was fascinated by the Eighth. And Montgomery, always Montgomery. What a compelling figure. Ah.
Yeah, indeed.
Every time you think you've figured it out, there he goes again.
Yep. Yeah, no, he's an extraordinary character.
Five, four. Make sure I've got everything lined up here. Three, two. Oh, I didn't say where we begin. We begin with the Italians at Cassibile. How do you say that?
Cassibile.
Cassibile. With
Cassibile.
Cassibile. With the arrival of Castellano. And that'll frame the story. They expect the Italians to surrender and come over. Five, four, three, two. This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It is late August, 1943, Sicily. Sicily has been conquered by the Allied forces, and the expectation is what comes next. This is 43, the year that the war turned against the Hitlerites. However, there's a great deal of tragedy ahead, and I welcome a man who's telling the story in terms of battles and in terms of people and certainly in terms of the politics of the moment. James Holland. The new book is The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943. James, congratulations and a very good evening to you. And I go to the meeting between Castellano, representing the Italian government, and Harold Alexander, Sir Harold Alexander, the commander he meets with, and other figures, and Cassibile in August, I believe, 1943. The understanding that has been hammered out some weeks and months before is that the Italians are leaving the war, and perhaps they're coming over to the Allied side. How much was that concern for the decision to invade Italy, the fact that the Italians would come over? What did that mean to the commanders in Sicily? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John, and thank you. And thank you for having me on. It's great to see you again. And good evening, everyone. Well, yes. Yeah, so the problem the Allies have is they don't really have enough shipping to do the kind of amphibious assault in strength that they need. They've got plenty of men. They've got plenty of air forces. They've still got, you know, a reasonable number of warships. What they don't have is enough assault shipping. And you need this because there aren't any ports around, so you've got to land on beaches. And what you want is lots and lots of landing craft and landing ships of various kinds. And they just don't have them because of the global demands of the war. So, but there's very compelling reasons to going into Italy, into the main part of Italy. And they convince themselves that one of the things that's going to help them, it's going to be in what you would say in modern parlance as a force multiplier, is the fact that the Italians are going to come over onto the Allies' side the moment they land, and they will fight to against the Germans and in support of the British and Americans and Allied forces. But the problem is the reason the Italians are getting out of the war is because they don't want to be fighting anymore. They've kind of slightly lost the kind of will to fight. Morale has plummeted, and Italy as a fighting nation is just a spent force. And the other problem is that the Germans have been preparing for precisely this scenario and have every intention of disarming the Italians just as soon as the first whiff of them coming out of the war reveals itself. So the problem is that no one's being straight with anyone. So the Allies can't be straight with the Italians because they don't really trust them. And there's going to be a lag between the signing of any armistice and the actual main event, which is going to be called Operation Avalanche, and which is going to be launched sort of south of Naples. So I guess about kind of some two-fifths of the way up, third of the way up the leg of the Italian peninsula on the western side. And it's just, it's all just a bit of a mess. It's a bit of a rush. It's a bit of a hurry. You know, the Allies are keen to sort of get on with it. The Italians want to be out, but they also want to make sure that they're safe and they're secure and they're not going to face the kind of retribution of the Germans. And one of the part of the deals of the armistice is that there will be a major Allied assault somewhere, but they're not going to tell the Italians where it is or when it's going to happen until just before it happens. Which will coincide with a global announcement of the armistice. And so everyone's sort of slightly second-guessing one another. And the reason Alexander turns up, who is the overall army group commander, turns up at Casabile is because the Italians are prevaricating again. And he wants to sort of show a bit of kind of, he wants to kind of instigate a little bit of backbone into the whole proceedings and get a bit tough. So he turns up and demands all sorts of terrible things. That if Castelloni doesn't sign immediately or pretty pronto, then you know they can expect some pretty dire consequences. And frankly, it does the trick. And at 4:30 p.m. on the afternoon of the 3rd of September, the fourth anniversary of Britain's entry into the war, the Italians do sign.
And that signature leads to the first instance of operations that are going to come forward over these next days and weeks and months. All tragic. The first instance is the landing of the British forces under Montgomery. We need to meet some of the commanders, James. You Yep. mentioned Harold Alexander. Bernard Montgomery is landing in the toe of Italy. That'll be the first operation. And then in the Taranto, the second operation, a little bit up the foot. What is the thinking of a landing all the way at the bottom of the peninsula? Why?
Well, the idea is to kind of draw off German troops from the main event and to make the Germans think that this is kind of, you know, and the Italians, this is where it's really going to happen. Obviously, part of the negotiations is such that the Allies reveal their hand to the Italians. Again, the problem is shipping. You know, if you think for Operation Husky, the invasion of Sicily on July the 10th, 1943, they had 1,243 landing craft of all kinds for that attack, where they were coming up against a number of Italian troops, but only two German divisions. By September 1943, there are 19 German divisions throughout Italy, and 8th Army have only got 268 landing craft in total for this operation across the Straits of Messina, which is very narrow. But that means you can only realistically take two divisions across. And if you think of a division as being the kind of army unit by which we judge the scales of armies in the Second World War, if you think about 15,000 men, give or take, you're kind of that's your kind of ballpark figure. But a 15,000 man infantry division, for example, has 3,000 vehicles. And, you know, one doesn't have to kind of think too hard about all this to realize that the logistics of transporting 15,000 men and 3,000 vehicles from one side of the sea to another, even if it's only a strait of a couple of miles, is still pretty demanding. And, you know, you need food and ammunition and supplies and fuel and parts and so on and so forth. And two divisions is all they can manage. And it's incredibly mountainous there. So it's incredibly easy to defend. And from a German point of view, you know, there's limited numbers of roads. The roads they've got are what we would call strade bianche, which is sort of white roads, dirt roads. You know, they're used for, you know, they're designed for horses and mules and carts and what have you. And, you know, the occasional kind of 1930s Fiat, but they're certainly not used to 3,000 vehicles of an infantry division or even more for an armored division, for example. And from a German point of view, you know, they're trying to hold the 8th Army's crossing a bay. Very easy to blow up mountain passes, tunnels, bridges, all this kind of stuff, and just hold up the Allies, the British, as they're crossing. British and Canadians, I should add. So the main idea behind it is just to kind of sort of draw German troops away from the main event, which is going to be 6 days later, on the 9th of September. Although the Italians don't know this at this point, and that's going to be Operation Avalanche, and that's where the U.S. 5th Army is going to be landing.
3 September 43, Operation Baytown, Montgomery lands in the toe, 4 years into the war. 8 September, yep. The announcement is made of the Italians leaving the war. Eisenhower makes the announcement, so does the Badoglio, the prime minister, yep. Marshal of Italy. And now we come to the main event, the landing, Operation Avalanche, by the Americans and Brits south of Naples. The book is Savage Storm. James Holland is the author. The Battle for Italy, 1943. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with the author, James Holland. His new book, The Savage Storm, is the storming of Italy, beginning in September of 1943. The presumption was that the Italians leaving the war, the Germans will leave Italy. Presumption. The Italians will come over and fight with us. The Germans will leave Italy. However, we want to make certain that the Germans do not leave Italy right away, withdraw to the north of Rome, and we'll take the south of Rome. Rome becomes important to them. James, I think we need to mention the mission here. Eisenhower is overall commander of the American forces and the British forces and the Canadians and the French and the New Zealanders, the Allies. However, yep. Ike needs to choose a battle commander, a battle captain for Operation Avalanche. He chooses a man named Mark Wayne Clark, who is not operations. He's planning. He's like Eisenhower. He's not like Patton. Why did he choose Clark to lead the Avalanche?
Well, Clark, I mean, like a lot of Americans, hardly any of the American commanders have seen combat because, you know, they've entered the war in December 1941. They haven't got into action until on the ground until November 1942 with the invasion of Northwest Africa. And so there's been limited opportunities for American commanders in the Western sphere of the war to have combat experience. Clark is an incredibly experienced commander. He has seen action, but not since 1918 in the First World War in France. He's extremely competent. He's extremely clever. He's ambitious, quite ruthless at times, but he is a man of proven courage, forthrightness, imperturbability, and sureness of decision making. So he's of the crop of German of American commanders. You know, he's earned his rights to high command as much as anyone, and as a planner and organizer and trainer of men, you know, he's proved exceptional. So he's a pretty good choice. I mean, Patton has been commander of Seventh Army. He's a little bit disgraced at this point, following the sort of the slapping incidents at the end of the Sicilian campaign. Bradley, who's been two corps commander on Sicily, is in need of a rest and is being lined up for a role in Operation Overlord, the cross-channel invasion, which at this time is still set for May 1944. So, you know, there's a sort of limited supply of people who could step up to that level. And Clark had been, was very close to Eisenhower, and they were responsible for bringing American troops over to Britain, training them up, getting them organized for Operation Torch, the invasion of Northwest Africa, which was, it has to be said, largely Clark's plan, actually. So, you know, he's as good a bet as any, but there's no question about it that giving someone like Clark, who is inexperienced at commanding an army force and indeed an amphibious operation in the Mediterranean, and giving him the main effort for the invasion of Italy, you know, that's quite a big punt. And it's a poor hand for him because he hasn't got anything like the backup of, say, someone like Patton had when he was launching Operation Husky with 7th Army back in July 1943, with all the kind of huge air forces, you know, 3,500 aircraft, you know, 240 warships, you know, the 1,000... 243 landing craft and all the rest of it. You know, he's got 359 assault craft for Avalanche. And frankly, it's just not enough. But it's based on, as I say, the principle of, that the Italians are going to come over and fight on the Allied side, but also on a pretty spurious piece of intelligence that was picked up in May 1943 that suggested that should the Allies land in Italy, the Germans would retreat immediately to the Pisa-Rimini line, which is about 200 miles north of Rome. So they think they're going to have a very easy victory. Well, that's fine as long as that piece of evidence holds true, and as long as Hitler doesn't change his mind.
Yes, we need to consider now Clark leading the Fifth Army, the first army ever assembled outside of the United States, I learned from James, landing a combination of American and British troops and Darby's Rangers, lots of heroism. D plus one, even though the shipping is inadequate, they're confident with the naval guns they can secure the beach. Clark worries about D plus 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 because the Germans,
exactly that.
The Germans are looking down upon them. I picture this as the Hollywood Bowl. You're landing in the orchestra
right.
pit, and you're looking straight up at German guns. Was that a concern
exactly
for Clark?
That. Oh my goodness, was it ever? Yeah, I mean, it's a Salerno is a nightmare. So the idea is that where can you land? You have to have air cover. So, and you need decent air cover. It's no good having air cover for 2 minutes and then they've got to bug back to Sicily or Malta or whatever. You need them for a decent stretch of time. And so the flat ground just to the north of Naples, that's ruled out because it doesn't give the Allies, the invasion forces of Clark's Fifth Army enough air support. Whereas Salerno does. The problem with Salerno is it's a 30-mile stretch between Salerno in the north and Agropoli in the south. And there's a sort of semicircular kind of alluvial plain, which is largely flat, but it's surrounded by hills and mountains on which the Germans obviously have put observers. On D-Day itself, on the 9th of September, when Avalanche is launched, there's only one German division in the area, which is the 16th Panzer Division. But in the southern half of Italy, there's some eight divisions, so six more than there were in Sicily, for example. And there's nothing to stop the Germans sending all of them towards Salerno just as soon as they realize that that's the main effort. And that's exactly what the German commander in the south, Field Marshal Albert Kesselring, does. He leaves once Rome is all tied up and he's defeated what Italian resistance there was in Rome. He leaves one division there and then sends everyone else pretty much towards Salerno. So he's chucking all his eggs in one basket. But it becomes increasingly clear to Mark Clark and the Allied commanders, Alexander, the Army Group Commander, and Eisenhower, the Supreme Allied Commander in the Mediterranean, that they can expect a pretty hefty counterattack in pretty quick order. And as it turns out, that comes into being on the 13th of September, so D plus four.
D plus four is the counterattack by the Germans. I've learned from James over several books now that the Germans always counterattack, always.
Always counterattack, always.
You can stop your watch on it. And
yep,
here it
Pavlovian.
Comes. One more detail before we accept the counterattack. The naval guns are, you spend time telling us how important they were. I learned that from Overlord, which is in the future. Did they count on the naval guns ranging against the Germans coming down from the mountain? We have less than a minute, James.
Yeah, they absolutely did. But again, they've got in total about 70 warships of varying sizes off Salerno, whereas for Husky, they had kind of, 240 or something. So it's just, they have got a lot, and it's a force multiplier for the, makes up for the shortfall of troops on the ground. But whether that's going to be enough to secure the bridgehead and make Avalanche successful, that's entirely up in the lap of the gods to a certain extent.
The book is The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943. James Holland is the author. When we come back, Kesselring counterattacks. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with James Holland, the author of the new book, The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943, The Rest of the Story. The Americans and British have landed Operation Avalanche south of Naples, between south of Salerno. The Germans, commanded by Smiling Albert Kesselring, a Luftwaffe general who is at this point given command of the south of Italy by Hitler. Were the north of Italy in the possession of Rommel and Army Group B. What is puzzling here is the politics in Germany, Hitler choosing back and forth always uncertain what's coming next around him. James, I spend time with the counterattack because it shows once again how the commanders are always looking over their shoulder to what will Hitler make of my decision. We need to meet Albert Kesselring. What is significant about him? He's not a Prussian.
No, he's not. He's not from that traditional kind of aristocratic military elite. He was an artilleryman in the First World War. Later out of the army post-war, then joined the Lufthansa, the civilian airline that was formed in the late 1920s, and then switched over to the Luftwaffe when it was formed in when it was announced in 1935. And he was a very able administrator, ends up being chief of staff after the death of Wavell in 1936, I think it was. Was an air fleet chief for Poland, and then subsequently the attack in the West, and then the Battle of Britain in the summer of 1940, before moving to, in late 1941, was given command of the Luftwaffe forces in the South, in the Mediterranean. He was responsible for the Blitz of Malta, for example, and steadily grew in authority and position, and became, you know, by this time was commander-in-chief of German forces in the South, which included kind of obviously naval forces, but army forces as well. And there were two army chiefs in Italy by the end of August 1943, beginning of September by the time of the invasions. There was Rommel in the North, Army Group B, and he had 11 divisions. And the plan was, as the Allies picked up back in May 1943, The plan remained at that point to retreat to the Pisa-Rimini line. And that was very much Rommel's thinking, because he thought, well, you know, that will shorten our lines of supply. I fought the British and the Americans before. I know what their air power's like. We don't want to be fighting on with long lines of supply down the leg of Italy. You know, we're making a rod for our own back. Let's defend up in the north where the mountains touch either side of the coast and make it absolutely impregnable. And we can hold the Allies forever there. That's his thinking. And Hitler actually buys into that idea. And but at this point, there is still 8 divisions in the south, and that is Army Group C, and that is commanded by Kesselring. And Kesselring decides at this point that he is going to throw all his eggs in one basket, and he is going to make his prime focus on kicking the Allies out at Avalanche. And then, having done that, he will then turn back to 8th Army, which is proceeding very, very slowly through the toe of Italy. And this is the Montgomery crossings of the Straits of Messina with those two divisions, the British 5th Division and the Canadian 1st Division. So that's the plan. But it is incumbent on them successfully kicking the US 5th Army back into the sea at Salerno.
The attack is launched very successfully at first against the 6th Corps, which is south of Salerno. If you look at the Hollywood Bowl, it's to the right, facing it. The British 10 Corps is to the north, and Darby's Rangers are north of them. Clark is already on shore, and his headquarters look to be on the axis of the attack. The way you present it, James, it's both exciting and, at this point, I thought they were going to lose. This is a ferocious attack, similar to what Rommel wanted to launch upon Overlord. Why, at this point, why does Kesselring not succeed? What holds him off?
Well, this is one of geography, really. It's really interesting. And I only really fully understood why this happened when I kind of went out there and walked the ground there. So what happens is the main thrust, and this is just a bad mistake by the Germans, is to try and isolate the southern part of the American forces in 6th Corps. And there's two rivers. There's the Selle and the Calore. And where the Calore meets the Selle, it's a kind of like a V-shaped. And obviously what the Germans were thinking, they were just looking at a map and they're thinking, well, it's September, you know, it's a hot summer, end of a hot summer. The water will be very low in the rivers. You know, we can just ford it. And in terms of water levels, you know, they were absolutely correct. The problem is that the cliffs there down into the river, about 15 feet. So completely unfordable. You know, you would need bridging. The problem is that what Clark does, because Dawley, who is the 6th Corps commander, has slightly lost the plot and is pretty ineffective. So Clark takes over personal command and directs two artillery battalions of field guns, which are, you know, these are howitzers that lob shells rather than direct anti-tank fire. And he puts them along this road. Well, the road stands above where these two rivers meet. So the armor of the German armor can't see them because they're above them. And although the field guns don't have direct sights over the German Kampf group or the German battle group, what they can do is they can lob shells into a very, very tight area of very dense German armor. And that's exactly what they do. In the space of about an hour and a half, they fire 3,700 rounds. And it absolutely stops the Germans dead in their tracks. And they can't go anywhere. They can't cross these rivers because the banks dropping down into the actual river floor are too steep. And so they just get stuck there. So although, as the crow flies, they're only about a mile and a half away from Clark's 5th Army headquarters on land, they might as well have been about 50 miles away for all the good it was going to do.
Clark's
and that is because that's the main thrust. It kind of rather takes the sting out of the out of the attack. And in the by holding off on the 13th, by the 14th, reinforcements of air power, you know, it's a maximum effort from the Mediterranean air forces, both the strategic air forces, the heavy bombers, and the tactical air forces as well, the kind of medium bombers and fighter bombers and so on, combined with growing numbers of warships, which are hurriedly kind of brought in, and reinforcements such as the 82nd Airborne, which is dropped very successfully on this occasion, that combines to stop the Germans in their tracks and prevent a complete catastrophe for the Allies.
This is when I like Clark a deal, because he throws the regimental band in. He's at Albanelli Station, which is right there at the battlefront, and it's almost as if they're coming for him. And he gives them the courage to stand up to that German armor. And one of the themes that you develop throughout the story is that Mark Clark has been not castigated, but not treated well through the decades since. Is that correct, James?
Yeah, it is. And what I've done with this book is I've really tried to tell it absolutely in the moment. I don't want to do kind of too much retrospective judgment. I want to judge the events as they're unfolding and through the perspective of the commanders and participants as they're seeing it at the time. And so with a break from how I've approached books in the past, I've tried to use about 80% of contemporary sources as much as I possibly can, including diaries and letters and so on, and including Clark's own diaries. I think it's very, very hard to criticize Clark for his performance at Salerno. At the end of the battle, when it's finally done, and actually the Kesselring calls it off at about 6:30 in the morning on the 17th of September and orders a retreat to the Volturno line, which is about 25 miles north of Naples, so about 45, 50 miles from where they are at St. Salerno Bridgehead. Clark writes to Eisenhower and says, you know, thank you so much for giving me this singular honor of commanding 5th Army. You know, many lessons have been learned, and we're determined to learn those lessons. You know, there's no complacency here whatsoever. Thank you for all your support. You know, we're going to strive to do better. And you kind of think, well, that's a really pretty humble, but also magnanimous approach. This is someone who's not taking anything for granted. He's not kind of crowing that he's pulled off a great defeat, a great victory. And although there is no question that it is the combination of Allied air, land, and naval power which has resulted in this victory, equally, the performance of the infantry, some of which are pretty underexperienced, not least the 36th Texan Division, who hasn't seen action before since the First World War, it's kind of hard to fool. I mean, they're pretty determined. They're pretty, you know, they do really, really well. They suffer badly, but they keep fighting. They hold their nerve. And Clark's command of the whole operation, where he's kind of everywhere, and careering around and managing all his troops and marshalling all his troops, I think with a deftness which is impressive for someone with his such little experience of high command, is really, really impressive. And, you know, you can argue the toss about Clark at the Rapido and subsequent events that take place in Italy, but you've got to judge him, I think, in the moment. And in the moment at Salerno, I don't really see he puts a foot wrong. having been dealt a very difficult hand, it has to be said. I cannot think of another Allied commander in the Western Hemisphere who is the Western theater of the war, who is given such a tough hand as Clark for a major of amphibious assault. It is absolutely the toughest one of all, and he pulls it off.
Watching Bernard Montgomery with the 8th Army on the Adriatic shore, east of the mountains, Montgomery is big war. What does that mean, James?
Well, big war is really is the British and also the American way of war, which is to try and keep the number of infantrymen and guys in tanks to an absolute bare minimum, and to have a very long tail of support behind them in terms of supply lines, supply troops, medical care, all that kind of stuff. And broadly speaking, I think the Allies do this pretty well in the Second World War. They don't do it quite so well in Italy because Italy is undersupplied compared to Northwest Europe, for example. But they still do it better than every other army of every major combatant. And to put this into some perspective, probably about 14% of these armies are infantry, whereas about over 40% are supply, service corps, service troops, and about 22% are artillery. And that's, that kind of shows you the emphasis on which the Allies are approaching this war. The problem is, if you are unfortunate enough to be an infantryman or in a tank, your chances of getting through unscathed are pretty much non-existent, particularly as an infantryman in Italy, which is particularly hard. But what Kesselring does by throwing all his eggs in one basket at Salerno is he leaves the back door open, and he's left only an understrength German parachute division, the 1st Fallschirmjäger Division, in the southeast of Italy, in Apulia, because some of those units have been sent to bolster the forces at Hitler's order, it has to be said, around Salerno too. And what that means is that the key ports of Taranto and subsequently Brindisi and Bari are left intact, because the Fallschirmjäger just do not have the strength to be able to blow them all up and destroy them before anyone else uses them. And they don't have enough numbers or enough weight of arms to be able to do more than a few rear guards and minings of roads and blowing up of bridges and so on, which gives the Allies this huge opportunity, because you don't need assault craft to go and land in a port. You just need ordinary ships. It's if you need to land on a beach that the problem lies with the Allied supplies of shipping, not going into a port. And so the British 1st Airborne Division is able to land at Taranto in the western side of the heel of Italy, basically untouched, unchallenged, and able to get into Apulia. And that means a very, very swift advance up the eastern side of Italy to the key area around Foggia, which is one of the very few flat areas of Italy, and where the Allies have earmarked for a series of strategic air bases. And it is for these air bases around the Foggia, around the town of Foggia, in this flat area on the eastern side of Italy, that is the prime motivation for the Allies for going into Italy in the first place.
I'm speaking to James Holland. The book is The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy. The Americans and British and Canadians and New Zealanders and French have withstood the counterattack and now on to Naples. But before that, across the river known as Volturno, this is John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with James Holland. The new book is The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943, Montgomery rolling up the Adriatic shore and onto Naples for the American Fifth Army. There are only two passageways through. The Germans pull back under Kesselring to the Volturno. I note that the major mission here is accomplished. The Germans have devoted a number of divisions to Italy to hold off the Allied advance. Foggia has been captured, leaving it open for the heavy bombers to arrive, and they can range into southern Germany, to Austria, to Romania, the oil fields of Romania. And the only mission that hasn't been accomplished so far is Rome. And I need to make a note here, James. At this point, It's September coming in October. Reaching Rome by the end of the year seems fantastic to me, and yet they keep entertaining it in their command decisions. Were there regrets afterwards that they took on so much in a short period of time, knowing how Kesselring was fighting?
Well, the whole of the Italian campaign is under the tyranny of Overlord. So Overlord is the cross-channel invasion, which at this point is still going to be taking place in May 1944, not the 6th of June, as it eventually plays out, has been agreed the previous May, the Trident Conference in Washington in May 1943. And that is the number one priority. And everything that happens subsequent to that and on the periphery of that is to support Operation Overlord. And one of the big concerns about Operation Overlord is that once you land on Normandy beachhead, the cat is out of the bag. And then it's a race for who can build up the biggest amount of supplies quickest. And obviously, the Allies have more supplies than the Germans do, but they're in England. And they've got to get across the channel, and shipping is a slow business, and unloading it is a slow business. Whereas the Germans are already on the continent. So on paper, it should be easier for the Germans to resupply. So the key to the whole success of Operation Overlord is that you would that you hold up the German ability to reinforce the Normandy bridgehead. And you do that by destroying bridges and marshalling yards and lines of communication. And you do that by very low-level precise bombing. And you can only do low-level precise bombing if you don't have Messerschmitts and Fokker Wolfs of the Luftwaffe hovering above to shoot you down. So you need to clear a vast wave of airspace over northwest Europe before you can even contemplate going into making an attack across the channel. The problem is by the second half of 1943, that's a long, long, long way off, and everyone's starting to panic. Well, how are we going to do this? We haven't got a long-range fighter that's coming in the form of the P-51 Mustang, but it isn't there at this point. So they're trying to think, well, how can we kind of further get to those aircraft batteries in the Southern Reich, which are beyond fighter escort from England? Well, you can do that by going into Italy and going to Foggia and going setting up lots of airfields there. So that's the plan. That's the prime motivation. But the problem is once you've got to Foggia, you then need a buffer because you don't want to invest Foggia with all the huge amount of resources that's required, oil pipe, fuel pipelines from the coast, supplies, ammunition, ground crew, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, only for the Germans to counterattack and you lose it again. So you need a buffer. And that buffer needs to be, you know, at least 50 miles north of Rome. Now, if you remember that the whole reason, one of the main reasons that the Allies feel confident of going into Italy and making this strike for Foggia with perhaps less troops than assault shipping than they would like is because they have intelligence that the Germans are going to retreat to the Pisa-Rimini line. Now, although Kesselring's counterattack at Salerno is an abject failure and completely, you know, destroys his entire plan for southern Italy, Hitler in classic Hitlerian fashion is rather impressed by his showing, sacks off Rommel, sends him to Normandy, gives Kesselring command of all of Italy, and says, I want you to fight for every yard south of Rome. So suddenly you've got a clash for the Allies that they're not expecting, or they were not expecting when they launched Operation Avalanche and indeed Operation Baytown in the toe of Italy. But because they've now got that prime goal of Foggia, they've got to protect it, and that means getting further north to Rome. Now, had the Germans done what they originally intended to do and retreat to the Pisa-Rimini line, then they absolutely would have been in Rome in very quick order. But as we know, Hitler changed his mind. They decided to fight, you know, insisted on fighting south of Rome, and so it became this absolutely horrific clash, meant that they didn't get there until the following June.
On to the crossing of the Volturno River by Fifth Army. James Holland is the author. The Savage Storm is the book. I'm John Batchelor. All right, that's the first hour. We go to Naples and immediately. Thank you. Five, four, three, two. This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, continuing with the author, James Holland. His new book is The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943. The Allies have landed in the south of Italy, south of Salerno, and at the boot and the toe of Italy. Montgomery and the Eighth Army are racing up the Adriatic shore. The plan is to reach a point where they can turn left and take Rome, along with the American Fifth Army, a combination of British and American forces coming up the west side of Italy and through Naples and then on to Rome. The mission of capturing Rome is seen as a major piece of success by the commanders and their political leadership. That would be FDR and Churchill at this point. Capturing Rome, a big plum. However, there are rivers to cross. As James has taught me, Italy has beautiful landscapes, beautiful, beautiful horizons, all those mountains, wonderful villages. But mountains mean rivers, and rivers flow to the sea. So the Allies, the British and the Americans and the Canadians and the New Zealanders and the French must cross river after river after river. And rivers, as James has taught me, are very easy to defend if you're waiting for the other side to cross with pontoon bridges, because you blow all the bridges, or to at fords that can be identified. The Volturno River is the first one that the Fifth Army must cross. And again, James, we come to the decisions made by General Clark. He believes in force, main force, on multiple fronts to cross the river. Is that successful against Kesselring? Does Kesselring combat it, or does he fall back with the way Clark crosses rivers?
Yes, it is broadly pretty successful. I mean, the Volturno crossings, which take place in the middle of October, following the fall of Naples at the beginning of October, again, it's they're incredibly successful for the U.S. Fifth Army, which, just to restate, involves both Americans and British troops at this point. And the problem is that the Italian campaign has been conceived in the sunshine of August and heat and sunshine of August, and been launched in the heat of September. But suddenly at the beginning of October, it starts to rain, and it just rains and rains and rains. And I mentioned earlier on the problem of Italian roads. There are some asphalted roads, but most of them aren't. And they're just simply not designed for the weight of traffic from a highly mechanized and industrialized armies, such as Fifth Army. And they're pretty quickly churned up when you particularly add torrential rain. And all the ground either side of them also gets completely drenched and waterlogged and muddy and all the rest of it. And what you have as the Volturno weaves through hills and mountains and then goes out into another coastal plain, you've got a little floodplain either side of it in the mountainous hilly bits, and then a complete plain near the coast. And this plain just gets waterlogged by rain and by rising river levels. And the Allies have got to sort of get across this. And what that means is you've got to use the main axis of advance, which is already there, i.e. roads, which canalizes the effort, which makes it incredibly difficult. So the fact that they managed to get across successfully in a matter of sort of 48 hours is incredibly impressive. But it also has great significance for future river crossings that Fifth Army undertakes later on in the campaign.
The Montgomery forces, there is a battle over a town called Termoli, and it is an example of how Montgomery fights the war. My memory, James, and you can help me here, is there's so many battles that become overwhelming the first several times you take notes, is that Montgomery puts together amphibious special forces and a drive up the roads towards Termoli. So it's a combination.
Yes.
It's the big war again.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got the SAS and you've got the commandos landing by sea first. And the point is to try and secure some key bridges across the roads before the Germans can blow them up. While 78th Division, British 78th Division attacks from the south. And broadly speaking, it's pretty successful to start off with. That all goes okay. But then the Germans counterattack again, and they send 16th Panzer Division, sort of fresh from its beating at Salerno, comes across. and a number of other forces. And for a couple of days, you know, it's a pretty stiff fight, but 8th Army does prevail. So again, that from Montgomery's point of view, that tells you that that's a pretty good proposition. The problem again is there just isn't enough assault shipping to continue doing these outflanking operations, which is clearly the way forward. And incidentally, is what the Germans assumed the Allies would do. So they do constantly keep German troops further north than they might otherwise have been because of fear of being outflanked and the Allies getting in round the back door, just as they did in Apulia, for example. But the limitations of shipping mean that the Allies actually can't do this anymore. So this is pretty much the kind of last hurrah for a stent. Well, until the Anzio landings in January 1944.
The joy and discovery of your book, James, is the diaries that you introduce us to again and again in your acknowledgments. You talk about the museums keeping diaries. Sometimes they have a diary and we don't know what happened to the diary keeper. Nope. These diaries, however, underline the humanity of all of the actors. So many of the books that I've read since, well, my life, take it from the American point of view or the Allied point of view. And then the Germans are unknown except for whatever they do that can be defeated. You have German diaries, one in particular by a medical officer named Maus, Wilhelm Maus, who is a Nazi from Marburg. And you have diaries from the Canadian Farley Mowat, my absolute favorite because he writes so well, and Harry Wilson, a piano-playing Irishman who's with the 8th Indian. And these diaries very much record, and from the point of view of with Harry Wilson, he is a cipher clerk, so he's back at HQ. And Maus, he's a medical officer, so he's at HQ. They give us depth of understanding of the decisions that are made at headquarters and the way the battle goes for the men up front. And from this point on, beginning of October, Termoli is the beginning of October, this is a nightmare. They can tell it's a nightmare. You talk again and again sympathetically towards the infantrymen on both sides, on all sides. They know it's a, I think, meat grinder would be the metaphor that comes to mind. And the Allies know this is happening. It's chewing up lots of men, and yet they're taking divisions from Clark and from Montgomery and shifting them to Britain for Overlord. So Overlord is weakening the Allied offensive at the same time the Germans are strengthening their defense. Is that correct, James?
Yeah, absolutely correct. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to interview hundreds of veterans of the war from many different nationalities and all around the world, including a large number of Americans, has to be said, but also Germans and South Africans and Maori and Indians and Australians and of course, Brits as well and Canadians and so on. But I was really struck when I was writing a book about a particular British tank regiment. I was really struck by the immediacy that one gets from reading letters and diaries. You know, they're written on that day. They don't know how the war's going to end or indeed whether they're going to survive it. And that's the other thing is that when you're interviewing someone, self-evidently they've survived or else you wouldn't be talking to them 60, 70 years on. But when you're reading letters and diaries, you don't know whether they're going to make it through or not. And quite often they don't. And I think the other thing is because if it's a well-written diary, such as Harry Wilson's or Maus's, their characters just ooze off every single page because this is cathartic. It's a confession. It's a kind of, you know, you're expressing your innermost thoughts. And so you're starting to reveal your characteristics, your likes, your dislikes, your anxieties, your worries, your feelings, your political views, all these sort of things. They start coming to the fore. And so you get a very clear picture of what this person was. And the old L.P. Hartley line in the go-between is that the past is a foreign country. Well, I can tell you, John, that when you're reading these diaries and letters, the past is not a foreign country at all. It's a country that seems incredibly immediate. And time shrinks. You know, I mean, 80 years ago is not very long, really, in the big scheme of things. But these guys just come back to life. You know, their 40-year-old self, their 21-year-old self, whatever age they are, they're just bursting off every page. And you know, the great privilege for someone like me is that you can put flesh back onto bones, and it's very affecting and moving and touching. And you find yourself sort of empathizing with these characters and caring about their fates and their thoughts and what happens to them. And Mouse is a really interesting case because you're right. He is an absolute Nazi, but he's not without compassion. He's not without humanity. He's a very cultured man. I mean, there's this amazing sequence where he's at 15th Panzer Corps headquarters near Mignano, which is going to be absolutely in the kind of melting pot of the violence to come. And he says, I know the war is coming. I know the front is coming. I know the war is going to hit this valley right now. I'm looking across this beautiful little village. The bells of the churches are ringing out over the valley. The chestnuts are, turning orange in the autumn, in the autumn air. The snow-capped mountains in the distance. It's this beautiful scene. And yet I know destruction's going to come. And yet the war will pass. This violence will pass. Nature will reclaim once again, and it will have a future. But the immediate weeks and months are pretty grim for this area. And it's so prescient, and he's absolutely bang on the money. I remember just being profoundly touched by reading this sequence and just how prophetic it was. I mean, just it's absolutely incredible.
The book is The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943. James Holland is the author. When we come back, the Germans dig in. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with James Holland. The new book is The Savage Storm, Italy, 1943. The Fifth Army up the western shore. The Eighth Army up the eastern shore of Italy, up the peninsula. The Kesselring forces dig in. The Bernhard Line and the Gustav Line. The Gustav Line is the one that Kesselring knows will hold or believes will hold. The Bernhard Line, however, is equally strong. These are river systems and mountains and passes that very much make it difficult for any military to cut through the pass because you know where they're going to be. You can train your guns on them. And the artillery is constant. One of the things that James makes clear is It's raining. And if it stops raining, the skies are filled with bombers. And when it starts again, the bombers don't come. So the air power that the Allies have enjoyed comes and goes through October into November. We come now to the Bernhard Line and the Gustav Line. Because the mission now has been achieved. And that's a puzzle to me as a reader, James. They have Naples. They have Foggia. They've drawn the Germans into the peninsula. They've withdrawn divisions for Overlord. And yet they're anxious that the Germans will counterattack. And then I counted up the German divisions. The Allies are outnumbered at this point, correct, James?
Yep. Yeah, they are in terms of manpower. Not in terms of firepower, but they are in terms of manpower. You know, and that's significant because, you know, the rule of thumb is that you should never attack unless you've got a 3-to-1 manpower advantage at minimum. And the Allies don't really have that, which is why it's all the more creditable that they make the progress they do. The problem is it's all about this cushion for Foggia. It's about protecting Foggia. You know, having committed to Italy and having committed to huge investment in the Foggia Air Force with the Strategic Air Force and the formation of the U.S. 15th Air Force on the 1st of November 1943, they've got to look after it. They've got to protect it. And that means pushing north of Rome. And it also means maintaining the initiative. Not in falling back onto the defensive. And what the Germans have been doing is all this time since Salerno, the retreat from Salerno, they've been building up these the defenses along two parallel lines, the Gustav Line to the north and the Bernhard Line, the Winter Line, as the Americans call it, just a little bit, 10 miles to the south. And one has to think of this as like a sort of double lock system on a safe door. You know, this is where the mountains basically go from side to side. That's not quite as strong as the Pisa-Rimini line 200 miles to the north of Rome, but this is a pretty formidable position. And the first key bit is the Mignano Gap, which is where the Via Casilina, which is the main road going north from Naples to Rome, passes through a sort of low valley, a few miles wide, but towered over by two twin peaks, Monte Camino on the southwestern side and Monte Samucro on the northeastern side. And then just behind that is the next big defensive position, which is the Gustav Line, which focuses around the where the road goes around the edge of the Monte Cassino Massif. And this is for 1944 and the future. But the next main obstacle for Fifth Army is the Bernhard Line. And it does stretch across the whole peninsula. And it's just an incredibly tough position because these peaks are kind of, 3,000 foot high mountains. And on there you have observers with incredibly good optics directing the artillery fire of the German guns in the valleys below onto this key axis going north. And for a highly mechanized army such as the Allies, you can't go forward unless you've got these arteries, these roads. But they're zeroed by German artillery. And what that means is the Germans have already worked out where to drop their shells to prevent the Allies using these roads and rail routes. And so until you can prize off the observers from the top of the mountains, which are, of course, protected by infantry, you're not going to be able to get through these valley passes. And that's the whole problem. So how do you get these observers and these German infantry off these mountains? Well, you've simply just got to go up them and fight them and kill them and get them off. But that's easier said than done in winter with very short days where you've got most of the time you've got 10 tenths cloud, so your air power is ineffective, and where it's cold and wet, and your supply lines that you're used to, i.e. highly mechanized ones, have been nullified by the steepness of the mountain sides and the terrain. And in place of trucks and vast arsenals of mechanized warfare, you're dependent on your own 2 feet and mule trains. And that's an incredibly difficult proposition. And to put this into some perspective, the U.S. Army Rangers spent 45 days and nights on one mountain, Monte Corno, when you consider that the Sicily campaign was only 38 days long. That's a hell of a long time to be in one place on one mountain, not achieving very much.
The book is The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943. James Holland is the author. I'm John Batchelor. Minutes to go. Thank you, James. We're on to San Pietro and Ortona. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor with James Holland, the author of the new book, The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943. This is the nightmare now. The rain, the lack of air cover because of the storms, the mountain peaks, the artillery that is constant, always in the background, always in the foreground. And the Germans are developing very carefully the defensive lines they know the Allies cannot penetrate. They're confident because they have the high ground. They're looking down on the Allies. The Allies must advance up a mountainside. And as James has taught me, these mountains are not covered with dirt and forest. They're covered with stone. So when a mortar shell or an artillery shell hits the stone, you get secondary effect of shrapnel everywhere, wounding people anywhere in all directions. These two facts weigh upon the infantry that must absorb the bulk of the battle because of the mud. You can't get the armor up. Remember, big war means steel, not flesh. That's how the Allies fight, which is different than the Russians and the Germans, as James has taught me. But because of the rains, the flesh must go first, and there are two battles that James spends a chapter on each because they exemplify the challenge for Fifth Army and Eighth Army. The first one I'm going to come to is Ortona, because the Fallschirmjäger, the German paratroops, they're very good quality troops, are dug in at Ortona, is my belief. And Farley Mowat is on the scene as the intelligence officer for the Hasty Peas, and he gives us an understanding of this battle, the arbitrariness of the mortar rounds, and the determination of the Germans to hold on. James, I don't recall, is this one of the flattened cities? You've been to Ortona. What does it look like today?
Well, it's actually in not too bad a shape, although there's plenty of evidence of the battle that takes place. It's not completely flattened, but it's destroyed. I mean, there's not a single building in the town that hasn't suffered some kind of damage. It's a really long battle. It begins on the night of the 4th, 5th of December, just a couple of miles to the south, where you've got this sort of weird landscape because you've got these sort of little plains, these little sort of overlooking the Adriatic coast, but cut into that are these fissures. First, the River Moro, which is a very sort of steep, narrow valley, and then there's a kind of sort of gorge which becomes known as the Gorge. And these are incredibly easy to defend, of course, because you can go on the south, you know, on the southern slope. No Allied artillery round is going to get you, so you can just wait there, set out the firepower, and then when the Allies advance over the Canadians advance over the land, you just got to come and move into your machine gun positions and off you go. So it's an incredibly tough place. The whole landscape is completely butchered. All the vines and olive groves are completely destroyed. It becomes an absolutely awful, ghastly mess of dead and bloated and rotting bodies of mud and carnage. Every single one of the Canadian infantry battalions is committed. The 90th Panzer Grenadier Division, the German 90th Panzer Grenadier Division, is completely destroyed. Effectively, it is then left one regiment of the 1st Fallschirmjäger Division, the 3rd Fallschirmjäger Regiment, which is, you know, about kind of, you're talking about 4,000 men strong, something like that, to defend the town once the Canadians finally get into the town. Having done this kind of sort of awful battle south of Ortona, they've then got the street battle, which of anyone who's been following the operations of Israel in Gaza City in the Middle East at the moment will know is just an absolute horror story. I mean, fighting in built-up areas is something you want to avoid at all costs. And so it just turns into this absolute slogging match, which becomes known as the Stalingrad of the Adriatic. And it's absolutely ghastly for everyone involved. And for people like Farley Mowat, who's just seen too much action since landing in Sicily back in July 1943, you know, he's losing the plot by this point. You know, he's combat fatigued and he should be pulled out of the line, but he's just got to stick it out. I mean, it's just horrendous.
Yeah, there's a moment it reminds me of scenes that I've seen in movies. I can't name the movie, where Farley Mowat is overwhelmed by shellfire, I believe, or an explosion, and he starts to go down the road by himself with no particular aim, just to leave, to get away. Human reaction. Mm. And one of his mates grabs him, as I recall, and gives him a sip of whiskey. And he comes. I felt like the scene was all of a sudden the buzzing in his brain stopped, and he realized he had to go back to the battle. Do I remember that? Was that Ortona?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, he's suffering from what he calls the worm, and the worm is fear, and it's when the fear is so great that your fear of being caught out is greater than the fear of losing. You know, is not as bad as the fear of losing your life. You're just basically losing your nerve. I think everyone has a sort of bank of courage, and you know, if you spend it, the bank becomes empty, and then you've got nothing left, and it needs replenishing. You know, funds need to be put in, and that means coming out of the line and having kind of a bit of R&R and all the rest of it. And he just doesn't have enough, and you know, he's not alone. And it's exacerbated by the mud and the conditions and the privations and the ghastliness of everything that's around them and the kind of scale of destruction. It's a tragic story. And there is one moment where, you know, he's just been sent back to go and find some Sherman tanks, and he gets blasted off his feet by a round of Nebelwerfers, which are sort of, you know, rocket mortars. And he lands on the body of a dead Fallschirmjäger. Scrambles to his feet and finds himself face to face with a wounded German soldier, young boy who's lost his arm and got a massive gash in his stomach and who's dying. And it's deeply traumatic. And he eventually sort of manages to get himself out of there, gets a ride back to the front on the tank. And when he jumps off the tank, his legs just buckle. He's unconscious. And he does recover, but you know, he's a spent force. And as I say, he's absolutely not alone, because in Ortona, there's a German fellow, a Fallschirmjäger, called Leutnant Pick, who also loses the plot. He's just lost his best friend. He drops his machine gun, disappears out, walks straight out into the middle of the square, points out a Canadian sniper, tells his men to fire, is promptly shot himself, and dies later that night. But what's prompted him to do that has been he's just lost it. You know, he's combat fatigued, and fatally so. So it's a feature of both sides.
Because they don't have enough personnel. They can't rotate. The Allies can't rotate the way that they will when it comes to the battle for Normandy, or the way that
exactly
they've been
that.
Trained. And what happens is these units get smaller and smaller, and they're asked to do more and more. So we go to the Fifth Army, San Pietro, which I know because of the Ernie Pyle column.
Yeah, my goodness me, that's so good, isn't it?
I was surprised to meet that column sort of your way. You know, I wasn't ready for, oh, so this is what happened. Because Ernie Pyle makes the death of the captain the centerpiece of the column, whereas here it's just part of the larger story of the battle for San Pietro.
Well, that column, you know, I was there at the foot of the mule trail the night they brought Captain Wasco down. It's one of the great pieces of reportage to emerge from the Second World War. And, you know, arguably, Ernie Pyle is the greatest war correspondent of the Second World War. You know, he's right up there with Vasily Grossman and other greats. But you know, for my money, he's the champ. And that piece is profoundly moving. But it was even more moving for me when I went up to the top of Monte Simucro, which is where Vasco gets killed. And you look around that and you just think, oh, my goodness me, how on earth are they trying to fight here? I mean, so much so that his battalion is reduced to only 155 men still standing out of kind of, you know, 850 by the following morning. You know, a night attack in the middle of the night, in the middle of December, on the top of a 3,000-foot high mountain. And as I say, when you go to the top of Monte Simucro, which overlooks the village of San Pietro, which is nestling on its lower slopes, you're just in awe of what the American troops, of what the Texans achieved there, because the German approach to the top is much gentler than the American approach, which is follows two ridgebacks, incredibly steep at parts, incredibly difficult terrain. And actually, from the top of Simucro, you can see the foot of the mule trail. You can see it's almost certainly the same one that Ernie Pyle was witness to. And it's profoundly moving to see it. And the trouble is, this is all part of this clearing of this valley floor. You can't do that until you've secured this key village, and you can't do it until you've secured the heights of Monte Simucro. And so it's left to people like Captain Wasco and his men to just knuckle down and get on with it. And, you know, huge loss of life and huge casualties are suffered as a consequence.
The Germans are the Panzergrenadier, the 29th. The detail here about the Italians, they're fighting these battles, these slugging matches with air and artillery and mortars and tanks on a landscape where 44 million Italians live everywhere.
Yep.
And these villages are constantly being flattened. Towns are no longer existing after the armies have moved through them. And in this particular town, San Pietro, there is a family. There are several families who hide in the caves outside of the town. Serafino Masella is the father of a family, and his sister-in-law, Rosa Fuoco. They're without water for days because when they sent two women out to get water from a stream that's below them, they were machine-gunned by the Germans. People are very hair-triggery here because any shadow can be an enemy soldier. So the scene that James tells us is how Serafino and Rosa determine that they're going to get water for the children. What happens, James?
Well, them and a handful of others. You know, and if you were to walk, so but what they learn is that there's a kind of water tank on the far side of the caves that they've dug under this little sort of tiny cliff face into the kind of soft tufa limestone of their one side of the village, and this water tank, which hasn't been kind of fouled by the Germans, is on the other side. And they think, well, we haven't got any choice. We've got to go and get some water. So they have to do that at night. But of course, the problem is that would only take you 10, 15 minutes to walk in daylight in peacetime. But at night, where you're trying to be super careful and not rouse any suspicion, you're not trying to rouse the Germans or indeed the Americans, who are just on the far side of the village, it takes time. It takes ages to inch your way silently through one side of the village to the other, fill up your pail of water, then make your way back. And unfortunately for Rosa Fuoco, she is still getting back from one side to the other with her pail of water when the first wisps of dawn stretch across San Pietro, this little village, and the Americans at the other end of the village just see figures moving around and assume they're Americans, so they open fire, and Rosa is gets a bullet through the heart, and she's killed. And when the Americans finally get through to and they finally take San Pietro on the morning of the 17th of December 1943, there she is, still lying there in the village piazza, clutching her pail with a bullet through her heart. It's a, you know, it's just, it's one story of many tragedies in that area. And, you know, the thing about San Pietro is the village was left abandoned afterwards, and you can still walk around the ruins of it to this day. And you know, it's a village that would have been remarkably untouched for centuries beforehand. I mean, you know, the rhythms of life, the annual rhythm of the seasons and the farming life would have continued largely untouched for centuries. And then suddenly the war descends on it, this terrific kind of typhoon of steel and destruction. And they find themselves caught up in the middle of it. I mean, it's just an absolute.
The book is The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943. James Holland is the author. We're going to Christmas, 1943. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with James Holland. His new book is The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943. It is Christmas, 1943. And all of the players' diaries are intact, except for those who are KIA or WIA. And ahead of them is a nightmare. And we need to build the nightmare because that comes next in James's presentation, the next book or whatever book it comes. I want to get to Rome, but we're well short of Rome right now. And above them all, above the Liri Valley that they've penetrated through, is Monte Cassino. What is that, James?
Well, Monte Cassino is the is a little sort of mountain massive which runs down to a little kind of sort of peak and a little point that sticks out over the Liri Valley, which is this sort of valley floor, wide valley floor, which is basically the route up to Rome. Along which the Via Casilina, Highway 6, runs from Naples all the way to the Eternal City. But right at the edge of this massive is a Benedictine monastery, which was abbey, which was founded in the 6th century by St. Benedict, and it's still there, and it towers over the Liri Valley and over the town of Cassino, which lies at the foot of the mountains below. And it's an obvious strong point because it overlooks the valley below, and particularly the road which hugs the mountains on that side of the valley. And of course, again, you know, the Germans are there and they've got observers up there, and they make this the absolute kind of sort of bulwark of the next defensive line, the Gustav line, which follows the cracking open of the Bernhard line, the winter line, which the Americans managed to prise open with the support of the British late December 1943. So having got through this terrible battle from kind of, you know, back end of from the beginning of November, 2 months worth of trying to hammer their way through the Bernhard line, the winter line, the start of 1944, they find themselves confronted with this next part of the kind of double lock system here, which is the Gustav line around Monte Cassino. And that's what they're facing at Christmas 1943.
Maus, he reflects that it's been a very bad year for the Hitlerites. Stalingrad, Tunis, the U-boats lost the North Atlantic, and the Eastern Front is a nightmare of losses. I don't think he's been to the Eastern Front, but he reads about it. And yet his motivation to continue to fight, I take it as an example of the leadership in the Wehrmacht at this point. They believed that Germany would be ransacked in the way that Italy's being ransacked. Was that his reasoning?
Yep. That's pretty much it. You know, they've you reap what you sow, and they've wrought huge amounts of violence and destruction on Europe and indeed on Soviet Union. And when things start to go badly wrong, they can expect the same in return. And Maus and other Germans that are fighting at the front, people like Jörg Zellner and Hans Golden, whatever, you know, they're looking at the destruction in Italy and thinking, this is what's going to happen to us. In fact, it's already happening thanks to kind of Allied bombers coming over on a kind of nightly basis and daily basis and pounding them. So, you know, what else can they do? I mean, do they just throw in the towel or, you know, and suffer Armageddon and suffer the kind of a catastrophe, or do they keep fighting? And it's a, these are the dilemmas in which they are having to confront at the end of 1943.
Farley Mowat, he's enjoying a moment at Christmas, but it's a very sad moment for him. Who is Alex Campbell? What does it mean to Farley?
Well, Alex Campbell is this sort of bear of a man. He's a lovely figure. He's much loved by his men. He's the Able Company commander, which by this point, Farley Mowat is the battalion intelligence officer, but he was a subaltern, a junior officer in Able Company when he joins the Hasty Peas, the Hastings and Prince Edward Regiment, and when he lands in Sicily. And Alex Campbell is this huge figure, and everyone absolutely loves him. He's actually been out with jaundice and has been wounded a couple of times, but he's now back, and he comes back, and he seems completely kind of unbreakable, and yet just before Christmas, he gives Farley Mowat this poem, and he says, "Oh, I've just written this. You know, you're a writer, Farley. You know, I'd love to know what you think of it." And he writes, and Farley Mowat in the kind of, you know, in this dark, damp building on Christmas Eve or the early hours of Christmas Day, reads it and is incredibly touched because it's full of doubt and fear and worries that he's not good enough for his men and that his courage is going to fail him and all this kind of stuff. And it just seems completely out of character to the personality that is presented, that Campbell presents to himself. And the tragedy is that on Christmas Day, the Hasty Peas go into attack and Able Company goes into attack. And part of that attack, Alex Campbell is cut down and killed. And, you know, again, you know, I was fortunate enough to read his letters, and they're very, very humane and very touching. And, you know, he's clearly devoted. He's not married, but he's in his early 30s, but he's devoted to his nieces. And, you know, he's sending them Christmas messages in early December and so on. And I went to visit his grave in the Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery in Ortona. And, you know, it's hard not to feel a lump in your throat, to be honest.
James Holland, The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943. The Gustav Line is up ahead. I'm John Batchelor. Thank you, thank you, thank you, James. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me on. And again, apologies for mucking around on the timings. I hope you're not going to be late for church.
I'm the pastor's up. My wife's a retired pastor. I'm never late for church.
Ah, very good. Well, listen, Happy New Year to you. Thank you for all your enormous support. You've always been very good to me, so thank you.
I look forward to the rest of the story, James. I'm sure it's coming.
Casino 44, it's coming.
Yes. And I also thank you for D-Day. I've listened to the reading now. It's a very moving telling, and it supplements the Sherwood Rangers.
Yes.
So the two books together go very well. Happy New Year
thank
to you and yours, James.
And to you. All the best, John. Take care.
Bye.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Chances are, you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your social security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info, and if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This Labor Day, say goodbye to spills, stains, and overpriced furniture with WashableSofas.com. Featuring Anabay, the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly pricing. Sofas start at just $6.99, making it the perfect time to upgrade your space. Anabay's pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and interchangeable slip covers are made with high-performance fabric built for real life. You'll love the cloud-like comfort of hypoallergenic, high-resilience foam that never needs fluffing, and a durable steel frame that stands the test of time. With modular pieces, you can rearrange any time. It's a sofa that adapts to your life. Now through Labor Day, get up to 60% off site-wide at WashableSofas.com. Every order comes with a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping, no restocking fees, every penny back. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.